Welcome to Inside Learning, episode 103, for the 13th of February 2013. Two things strike me. Time of the week again. Welcome to Inside Learning.
Good evening, Matthew. It's good to talk to you again. Wednesday night wouldn't be the same without you.
Yeah. It's interesting reflecting when there's just the two of us. I suppose we should say up front, those of you that were tuning in, hoping to have the Liverpudlian tones of Jay, unfortunately Jay's been detained in a couple of I think his family things have kind of caught up with him, so he sent his apologies yesterday and promises to join us when he can, and we'll look forward to that. So it's just Dee and me, Steve, but it's a nice chance, I think, tonight for us to reflect and play with some thinking we've been doing recently.
Yeah,
I mean, the cast has been going pretty well, you know, compared to our fears and indeed some of our expectations. You know, we've got steady growth and we're certainly on that lovely place between 2,500 to 3,000 downloads a week. A month. A week would be great. 2,500 to 3,000 a month. And obviously we're doing something right, but it'd be nice to be open to perhaps doing something differently as well, you know, to keep moving it on and keep growing. The other thing to reflect on is we've had some fantastic guests recently, you know, since our 100th night, and we've got a few more lined up. And rather than break the flow at the end, I'll just say right now, we get Charlie Love next week, the writer and creator, if you like, of the alternative system to the Scottish intranet system, Glow. He's come up with the rival Glue, which appears to be getting some traction as a possible way forward for our next generation. So it's going to be great to talk to him, because he's very much an educator, not just a tech head. So it's going to be good to unpick that. But anyway, here we are. We've got time to chew the fat. Mm-hmm. So where will we go with it tonight? Well, we kind of talked before the program, haven't we, about a kind of a way of trying something different tonight?
Yeah, because we thought we'd just start off with a couple of news stories, wouldn't we? But we were very much thinking when we started this program about how education ought to be conceived of differently. You know, than if schooling. If we're sort of trying to do the same old things, just harder and faster, and it's not working, then perhaps it needs some radical thinking. And part of our conversation on Inside Learning has been trying to reach towards new ideas about that thinking. But we were just reflecting, weren't we? We haven't done a great deal of that sort of free-flowing thinking recently.
Yeah, it's because there's always so much interesting news that we managed to pull out our attitudes, and you know, we use the filter of our own various belief systems and our reading to interpret the news, but it does sometimes distract us from getting down to a bit of future thinking.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
I suppose if we did too much of it, we would run into the same ideas anyway, and it would get stale for people that don't have the opportunity or the freedom to go and try out that kind of radical thinking. But once in a while, we definitely we need to get in touch with that. I jokingly said when we were chatting midweek that we should have a series that, you know, that would be like a sort of a game or whatever we'd play with guests. What would Ted do, as a kind of a homage to what would Edward de Bono do if you said, right, here's our challenge, you know, and you know that lovely idea he uses of provocations, you know, getting you to think differently by using different personalities or different situations. You know, I'd like us to try a wee bit of that at some point. I don't know whether we might play with a little of that tonight.
Mm-hmm. Okie dokie.
And then again, we might not.
So shall we start with our usual news roundup? A couple of items and then...
Yeah, absolutely. Do you want to go first or shall I?
Oh, well, I go first because I think your item might lead into a discussion.
Okay.
It was just... I noticed the Education Endowment Foundation toolkit. We have mentioned this toolkit before. It was a combined thing with the Sutton Trust, and it involved researchers from Durham University. And it was the toolkit that looked into relationship between spending and pupil outcomes.
Oh yes,
and trying to get a series of things that could say, well, actually, if you for a little money, you know, you'd get this much gain. For a lot of money, you might get this much gain. And looking at a range of interventions.
Reminded me a great deal, Steve, of the John Hattie research that was more about educational interventions in general. Do you remember that?
Yeah. He's New Zealand, is he, or Australia?
I believe he's a New Zealander, yeah.
He is, yeah, that's right, John Hattie. Yeah, no, that's worth following up. They kind of looked at gains in terms of months' progress, and then costs, they've got pound signs against each intervention, going from £1 signed up to £4 signed. So if it's got a £1 signed by it, it's very low. The cost is, it says, up to £2,000 per year per class of 25 pupils, or less than £80 per pupil per year, which is very, very low. And then at very high, it's over £30,000 per year per class of 25 pupils, or over £1,200 per pupil. So that's a kind of, if you like, a metric by which to gauge the sort of input you're going to have to make if you want to get some use out of that intervention. And then there's a whole series of interventions. So, for example, I'm just trying to find one, but things like, if you take feedback, so this kind of notion of assessment for learning, it's got a £1 sign by it. And the gain is plus 8 months, which is on the high side. Mm. So it's saying actually for very little investment in terms of money, you're going to actually get quite a high learning gain.
And I'm reluctant to ruin your flow, but that was number one in the John Hattie list as well.
Interesting, yeah. Right. Because it had metacognition and self-regulation, so the whole notion of knowing about your learning and controlling impulse and so on, that's kind of got low cost. It's £2 signs, that's right, plus 8 months. Peer tutoring is high on the list. That's got £2 signs and four star. Oh, they give it a star rating as well, plus 6 months. And then fourth on the list, which is obviously, five stars is the highest one. My eyes are going, just reading the screen. That's obviously a very high cost intervention, but it does give you significant gains, and that's early years, you know. So it goes down the list. So things like one-to-one tuition, homework, collaborative learning, phonics. Interesting, in light of the phonics debate at the moment. I mean, obviously it's very kind of low cost, £1, but with a plus 4 month gain. So that's kind of mid table, if you like. Down the bottom, which I find really interesting, because it says a lot and backs up actually a lot of the research at the moment, ability grouping. And I know a lot of schools are into ability grouping. It's got £1, so it's obviously low cost, but actually there's no gains, minus 1 month. So that's a kind of minus score. So it actually detracts.
That would be an average score, I would guess, then, because we've seen enough research on that over the years that, you know, sometimes there are small gains with one group, but more groups lose than gain.
Yes, that's kind of, they've got, obviously, the statistical modelling, they've worked out an effect level, some sort of correlation, but I guess, yeah, you would be averaging out, as you say, because there will be peaks and troughs in that. Mm. Interestingly, here as well, teaching assistants are not very high. Actually, there's no gains, heavy investment. And 0 months in terms of gains. So, you know, obviously you can argue about the metrics but I think it pulls together a lot of research. It just demonstrates that for some, you know, very small outlay in terms of resources, you can get some quite significant impacts.
I think that might end up being a theme of tonight. Now, we've covered that story in that detail before. The context... I may be wrong. I'm going to be embarrassed here. There's a trouble recording a podcast. You have to think on your feet, and someone will go and check the archives and say, no, he's wrong. I think it was in the context of the pupil premium that we did it.
Yes, because it was actually how you could best use the pupil premium. So it's got a pupil premium calculator.
And just to remind our non-English listeners, the pupil premium, I don't remember the fine detail. It's a grant, is that right? Tell us about that again.
Yeah, well, it was a grant given to young people to help them, you know, those particularly in need. And under the New Labour, I think it was paid directly to young people. So it was to help support them in education, secondary education.
These would be disadvantaged young people, or from areas that are... Or is it just a standard per capita?
think it was particularly, I think, I'm not sure what the thresholds were, but there were kind of thresholds put on it. But young people I talked to said, you know, it was sort of, it's the sort of thing that, along with the educational maintenance grant, that help them, you know, could support them in many different ways. This government have obviously, given the sort of financial situation, have reduced the amount and they pay it directly into schools. I'm not sure, I'm a bit behind on the news, I'm not sure how it's been doled out at the moment, but they were saying, well, it's up to schools to target it. And I think the notion of this toolkit is actually to help you, you know, how to spend your pupil premium, how to spend it wisely. So I think the value of the premium, I think it's going to rise, and I should know this, but it's going to rise up to £900 in a couple of years' time. I think when it was first out, it was currently around the £600 mark.
£600 rings a bell, yeah.
For each eligible pupil. So I think it was a free school meal criteria. And going back, yeah, it was a free school meal. The pupil premium was this government's intervention, and it was introduced to replace a previous government grant, which I think was paid directly directly to young people, because the young people I was kind of researching with said, yeah, it was really useful for stuff like bus fares and getting to colleges, and if say a young person wanted to do a course that the school couldn't provide, they might go to an FE college or an outside setting, and that grant, the educational maintenance allowance, helped them to do that kind of thing. So a lot of them missed it. And as I said, it's allocated directly to schools now, and it's up to schools, which is obviously more work for schools, to show how they can. It's up to them to distribute it.
Yeah, interesting.
Sorry, I was bubbled away.
No, you were presumably reading down the document to just try and get the fine detail of that there.
Yeah,
it's always hard to do that. Okay, so it's obviously a really practical tool. I remember when we looked at it before, we kind of liked it then. Ties in hugely with the John Hattie research. Just another brilliant summary of the research, because I think one of the things we've always agreed is it's quite hard for schools to make sense of research, you know, and it can become, you know, it can become okay for someone to have a hobby horse around class size reduction, for example. But when you're spending the money, you have very little way of justifying whether that is a good way of spending it or not, whereas these toolkits give you some sort of a scaling or an averaging kind of effect factor.
And the other thing I should say about the toolkit, which I should mention, which is quite useful, the star rating, so you get a 1 to 5 star rating, is about how good they think the research is, or how well researched that area is, if you like.
Right.
For example, peer tutoring gets 4 stars, which meaning there's actually quite a good body of evidence to suggest its efficacy. Uh-huh. Whereas performance pay, which actually seems to have no impact in the research they found, only gets 1 star, and that's probably because there's a paucity of research evidence around its effectiveness.
Yeah,
so it's quite useful, that star rating. So there's very very limited quantitative evidence of the impact from single. So there's no systematic kind of evidence.
I suppose it's also worth just praising the Sutton Trust, because they've done a few things that we've picked up on, and we've always picked up on them because they've been helpful. They seem to me to be a body that you don't just have their heart in the right place, but they seem to be pretty good at interpreting data and exposing, you know, the kind of equity realities for our schools.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they've obviously kind of philanthropic venture, I think, set up by. Oh no, I shouldn't have started that story because I'm going to.
Well, I was actually just wondering as you were speaking there, who's the guy? I'll come to you as soon as you stop thinking about it. But yeah, I know the guy you mean.
Kicking in already, yeah. But basically, a philanthropic. And yes, they are about supporting education to do better in terms of equity.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a kind of a light-hearted feel about it, though, because while I'm saying that it's very useful to be able to, you know, to have an effect size and a degree of certainty around the research quality, it does feel a bit like a computer game now, doesn't it? You know, not that I'm a, you know, big computer gamer, but you know, I remember games in the early days of gaming, like Elite, you know, when you had a certain amount of money and, you know, laser cannon for your spaceship cost so many credits, you know, but a better drive, you know, would be so much. You had to balance all these things. So it feels a wee bit like that. It makes you wonder whether there'll be someone in the management team of schools that's the games master, you know, that goes online, slays government ministers and local authority representatives to get extra credits to buy more to buy more pupil intervention.
With the ultimate prize of deposing the Secretary of State.
Exactly, yeah. I guess it would need to be some sort of play on Second Life, wouldn't it? You know, it would be kind of, you know, Second School or something like that. Ah, dear. Anyway, stop fantasising, Matthew. Right, well, what have I picked up? You're quite right. I suppose it is one that may well lead on. Lots of people this week will have picked up this story, which I think has... Go on, guess how many key aspects I think it's got.
How many key aspects? To what, to this story?
Yeah, or that I've noticed. Well, you can't get this wrong after last week. Oh, you're kidding me on. Are you teasing me?
Yeah.
Oh, you swine. Big, cute, intelligent swine. Yes, I did actually, just following the pattern, I think there were two key aspects to this. I need to stop that. I'm going to have to self-censor for this. The first one, which I'd really like to mention before talking about the story, because the story is about the UK being identified as pretty weak in the OECD international comparisons for fairness. You know, in other words, how good are their schools at, you know, at equalising society and giving people with disadvantaged backgrounds, you know, equal opportunities educationally. We don't do well. But the story that I think is kind of the second one for me in this is, this story's been done before. It seems to me, you know, doing what we do, tracking the kind of main interesting education stories, I guess from our narrow viewpoint, really makes you realise how the same stories keep on coming back on the news sites as though they're brand new stories. We covered this when the PISA results were out, and I don't remember Wednesday, but it would be, you know, autumn last year. And we picked out from the data, indeed the data had a summary in it, you know, an executive summary, which I think also mentioned then, you know, from OECD, that the UK was weak in school fairness rankings. There were big news stories at the time about our performance, about, I think, the relatively good performance of Ontario was first highlighted in that particular one. And this was there. It was in black and white. You didn't have to mine the data. Why is it suddenly out now? Now, I get that the OECD has perhaps put out another report summarising, which is what they've done, isn't it? They've now summarised their kind of further number crunching on it. So they're, you know, they're focusing on that area, but there is nothing new has come out of this for us that didn't come out of the original reporting of this.
That's right. And I think the key thing, which is, as you said, been in the data, and we picked up on this some time ago, was the gap that's growing between rich and poor in this country in educational, you know, we've got the lowest social mobility.
Yeah, yeah. So before we go on to talk about the problem of the report, I think the interesting thing here is OECD have clearly spent a lot of money getting researchers to mine their data to come up with this headline that we did on Inside Learning just a few months ago. They should employ us directly. Because we could give them the same quality of data, but with added puns.
We'll always be able to pick out two key points.
We can always get two. Well, yeah, I could anyway. You'd probably get seven or eight. I like to pretend I'm clever by identifying two, because that's all my brain will hold. So anyway, getting back to the first one, which was the issue itself. just to reiterate, we are in a position where our results are okay. We're mid-table for results, but we're bottom of the table for equity. The countries that they've identified as having high results in the comparative PISA studies and the high degrees of equity, interestingly enough, correlate strongly with the top countries in in PISA results. So it's Shanghai, which is a state, I think, obviously, rather than a country, Hong Kong, Finland, South Korea, Canada. Am I not right in saying that they are pretty much the top five or six anyway?
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that they achieve that with equity. That's a fascinating thing.
It is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I won't go down. I mean, the rest of them include Estonia, Netherlands, Liechtenstein, Italy, Taiwan, Ireland. You know, these are all countries that are doing well educationally and have equity. But we're not managing that, and that's pretty shocking. But I think the interesting thing for us to reflect on is that we've pretty much always been a divided society. We're a pretty old society. And I think there's a correlation, isn't there, between old societies and the gradual squirreling of wealth into a smaller number of hands. I'm not certain about that because I'm not really clearly I'm not an economic expert, but certainly see that pattern. You don't see the same degree of it in other new countries, like Canada, for example.
No, I think. One of the reasons this story came up is probably after sort of Gove's U-turn with the exam thing and the bashing he got over his speech. I wonder if this is they've put this out just to show that actually, despite all the money that New Labour spent, they didn't do very well in performance terms. So I wonder if this has come out as a political statement from the department.
That's possible, yeah. But interestingly enough, both of the main parties, Tories and the Labour, have actually used parts of it as evidence that the other has failed. So if they hope to cast any light on a political divide there, they haven't done so. It's all heat, no light.
Yeah, I think one of the issues, as you said, about the kind of the old society in terms of wealth is this notion of meritocracy. We've never understood it properly. And Michael Young coined the term, sociologist back in the 50s. He wrote a satire about it, which Tony Blair, with complete lack of irony, picked up and said, we want to develop this meritocracy. But he said that, the thing with meritocracy is that you'll get promoted on merit now, but once you're there, you want to maintain that position for your children and pass it on. So a meritocracy will always be self-sustaining. It will always be exclusive. And that's one of the ironies of it. And I think there's a certain degree of accuracy in that as a broad, just as a very broad historical sweep. We have a society which does like to cling on to its privileges.
Oh, absolutely.
If you've got them.
Yeah, and why, why should you let them go? If you've got them, of course. It's no secret that wealth is having wealth to start off with is the best vehicle for generating new wealth. You loan your wealth to others under conditions, and you get more back. And other than for some people in the middle of the kind of wealth range, then that's always true, has always been true, and there's nothing politically seems to be on the horizon to change that. So
it seems a kind of almost heretical future thought, but given this, the global economic situation, and given that some economists said actually the major economies could be bumping along the bottom for some time to come, we've not really talked as a society about the issue of actually are we I suppose overspending anyway. I mean, if you know what I mean, is this an opportunity to for some people to lessen their aspirations materially? Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely.
That sounds, and in some ways that's a kind of dreadful statement to make when there are so many people in this country who live in relative poverty and are excluded. But there's a job to be done, isn't there, in kind of curbing the excesses of consumption in order to bring people up. I mean, I suppose we don't want to. Would a society where everyone's the same? There's an argument there about whether it would work and about human nature and so on. But I'm just thinking there's a role for schools to think more broadly about can humankind sustain this level of consumption with the planet. I suppose it's an ecological question.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. That's right. Yeah. I think any glib answers to this are going to be kind of meaningless. I've just given one about old countries being very good at, you know, squirreling the wealth among the upper echelons. But, you know, and I suppose the link there is obvious that those people can then afford to buy privileged education. And that keeps the divide. But then, of course, you've got that aspirational middle layer that can afford to buy housing that takes them into areas that means you get hothoused, you know, state schools that are, you know, that are better schools. And we know that statistically, if you can get yourself into those, you know, in a way that doesn't reflect average spreads of intelligence, whatever that is precisely, you know, you will do better. So I think there is an argument there. But you look at the top sort of five in the results and equity table, it's Shanghai, as I say, Hong Kong, Finland, South Korea, Canada. They're all quite young. Not so much Finland. I'm not so sure about Finland. I don't know much there about their kind of culture and economy. But the other ones are all, you know, relatively young and new countries. Canada's interesting, though, because it's probably similar to America in its development. But America doesn't do well in this one. So that's why I'm saying a glib answer doesn't work. You need a much more sophisticated analysis. Why is Canada so equitable and the United States not? I'm not so sure, because they are similar ages of country, aren't they?
Well, in terms of their modern, you mean their modern democracies, I suppose they're all founded on stripping the natives of their territory. And in terms of Canada, I mean, I know there's a linguistic divide, isn't there, between the French and the English speaking. But I don't know, I get the sense that, because I've been to Canada and have Canadian friends, and obviously, you know, they do have issues with poverty, but I get a sense as kind of a bit more, it's a bit more of a homogeneous society in many areas of Canada. It's so huge.
So I guess that's the one thing we can say, is where a society is more homogeneous, it's likely the schooling will reflect that. But here in the UK, we're not a homogeneous society at all. And taking school results out of it, what New Labour must have been desperately depressed by was at the end of their 10-year or 12, 13-year, was it 10-year? 12 years, was it? That they had to concede, no doubt reluctantly, that they hadn't narrowed the poverty gap in the way that they had tried to do.
Although, if you look at some of the statistics, there were a large numbers of children who had been lifted out of poverty. And attainment and achievement had risen. It's just the gap has
just been... Just the gap, yeah. It seems to be that those at the top continue to grow that wealth. You know, that's the problem. And then the middle layer continue to aspire to be part of that upper layer.
Yeah. And I think part of the problem is that we're just driven by so much short-termism, isn't it? I mean, this is, you know, and we probably mentioned this before on the program, but things like the Sure Start Initiative... which focused on that early years intervention, put a lot of resourcing in it, and the notion of a children's centre. That's a long-term strategy. You know, that's going to outlive a politician's political life. And the problem is we have a kind of system of politics in this country that thinks only from one election to the next. And doesn't look at that long-term investment. So I wonder whether... In terms of we wanted to do some future speculation, I wonder whether one of the issues is actually whether our institutions have to do more of that long-term investment thing. So you have to trust schools and communities at a very local level to do long-term thinking together.
That would be interesting. We must move off this story and onto our chat. But Shanghai, as I say, Hong Kong, Finland, South Korea, Canada, do they have... short or longer term political cycles?
Well, presumably Shanghai. I mean, it has a lifetime. You re-elect the Communist Party leader, but you don't re-elect him. Some cabal appoints the Communist Party leader every whatever it is.
I would have thought so, but is that true in the States? Do they have any kind of devolved, you know, local system?
I don't, because there's a federal system, isn't there? And then there's the state system, and I don't know how that works. And but they have local school boards as well.
I don't know either. Hong Kong, I have no idea that. It was a governorship at one point, but presumably they've put in a more Chinese system now. Is it still something similar to that, though?
I don't know. I'd be completely ignorant.
Yeah, you see, so this is the kind of stuff that you'd want to get into, you know?
Absolutely.
And Canada, you know, is it got a similar electoral cycle?
Yeah, I think so. It's a parliamentary democracy on the lines as ours, yeah.
Right, this could be a thesis, right? Right, okay. This is this is perhaps why OCD haven't come running to employ you and I, Steve. maybe they were right to go for those economic experts and statisticians. I thought they were very foolish, but now that I reflect on it, oh dear. Anyway, so I guess we could have a wee think about that just now then.
Yeah, I mean, what
this is as vexed a problem as we could face, isn't it?
Yeah, and what I was saying is whether the state kind of sets a national framework in a way that in England the 1944 Education Act almost tried to do, and that actually it's very much at local level where you would decide with the institutions in particular communities what kind of long-term investment patterns were needed. And so you need to build up a very kind of strong, stable local democracy. And I think some of our schools are too big.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we they're just too big. They're just kind of, and you need we need a, well, I mean, we can't sort of, it'd be unrealistic to sort of take them apart, but whether you could break them down internally into smaller units so that there's much more of a community feel and dialogue within them that you could discuss some of these issues.
Yeah, yeah. I just wonder where to really start with this. There's so many variables we could start to think about, because we just talked about the political system, you know, and the governance of schooling in general. You know, is there something here about taking schools out of the political cycle? Would that be the beginning of starting to lay the foundation for equitable policies?
Well, you can't take them out completely because you need some sort of representative democratic decision-making process which sets priorities and values, don't you? You need some political, national political forum, but you need to devolve them much more. So there's a balance between having a much greater integrated local community and some broader national politics, which is about discussing your national values and your purposes and setting out funding priorities and political priorities. But actually the kind of major decision points in terms of what goes on in those schools and how they run and how they invest and how they connect are very much a local practice issue. And at the moment, very centralized sort of system, very short-termism.
Yeah. Yeah, is there a parallel here with the Bank of England under New Labour?
What, you mean in terms of an independent commissioner?
Yes, a kind of I suppose intended it to be total, but at least a by and large separate governance of all schooling, which would allow political influence on the body in terms of thinking, but wouldn't allow the kind of wholesale changes imposed by government ministers that we're seeing at the moment.
Yeah, no, it could be, yes.
So there would be like a, I can't think what you would call it, but there would be a, you know, see, no snappy name for it, it's never going to work, you know, like a, you know, a Scottish or an English school governance, you know, organization, and they would have a 20-year mission, not a 5-year mission, you know, to really consult and certainly to listen to politicians, but to be politically separate from them. You're not accountable directly to ministers in the way, you know, that we understand that just now, except where they're adjudicating on you know, problems or lack of performance, but that would be all.
Yeah, and the problem is how do you kind of organise that accountability? I mean, it'd be interesting to see how these new police commissioners work out in England. You know, I suppose is that a parallel political formation?
They're still quite directly political, aren't they? I mean, the government still has their hand directly on those levers.
Yeah.
What I'm talking about here is really quite separate, you know, take the hands off the levers. You know, the government wouldn't have any mechanism to step in and say, we're creating academies or we're changing the LEA governance. You know, the idea of separating the accountability cycle so that you don't get, you know, yo-yoing back and forward between, you know, between the country's tidal swings of political mood And you could have a commission that was, it could even be elected, you know, but it could be elected not on a party basis, but elected on an individual basis that lots of people could serve on it, you know, for a period of time. You could have, you know, 50 minds on it that worked away on it, you know, and tried to solve the longer term problems and took academic input and looked at international comparisons, you know, and really had the freedom to, you know, to work over a long period of time.
Yeah, and I think, well, if you had such a body that was working in partnership with local elected officials and national officials, so it wouldn't be a kind of, because you'd still need some political accountability in the system, wouldn't you? I mean, the trick is, how do you make it so that you've got accountability for the politics of values and the spending decisions that's accountable to people in general. I think one of the issues generally is we've not got a participatory democracy at any level, have we? Our representative democracy, well, we have a vote once every 5 years or whatever. And the kind of the notion of participation is at a different level of democratic involvement. So I suppose if we're talking politics of future schooling, one of my other notions is actually we've got to make our schools much more accountable to young people and their communities. Yeah. So that those schools are much more about encouraging political debate and engaging young people in that notion that actually they can participate in civic life, so that when they're adults, they've got some sort of modelling of those processes.
I've got a challenge to that, mind you. Just a counter view for, you know, just for thoughtfulness. That's all. Accountability at the moment is perhaps one of the reasons why we have the diversity that we have, because accountability seems to me in schooling to really move the focus, in a lot of cases, from the commitment of the parents and the commitment of the society members to, you know, to capitalising a good education, to being about the system and its lack of ability to deliver what parents need. And of course, at the moment, you know, the better off parents are, the better they are at being advocates for their own needs.
Yeah.
Just to be clear, I'm not suggesting no accountancy or local accountability. I'm just saying that I don't know if it would be a strong driver of equity.
Right.
In a sense, a system of ombudsman or something similar would probably do a better job of advocating than local communities, because my point is local communities that are poor tend not to be very good at this.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that they couldn't be, but at the moment I don't see much evidence of it. As Stephanie Young, who guested with us on Series 1 of Inside Learning, said, you know, if the poor parents of Glasgow had any idea just how completely a small minority of middle-class parents dominated the accountability of the school system, they would be sick.
Yeah, yeah. No, so I think I meant that we've got to have fora in which local people, local communities can get more directly engaged in schools, and schools are more directly accountable at the local level. And part of that, I think, starts with being accountable to young people much more directly.
Yeah. Yeah, I certainly wouldn't disagree with that. No, absolutely. What about the challenge of having the prestigious schools, you know, whether private schools or whether, you know, magnet state schools? How could future schooling address that? I mean, presumably we can start from the viewpoint we don't want to pull down the performance levels of the, you know, the magnet schools. It's about getting the other schools to be able to compete.
Yeah, well, there's a can of worms, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, sometimes I think, you know, while you have a private and a public system, is it always going to be, you know, divided? I mean, I really don't know the answer to that. I wonder whether part of it as well is whether we need to look at the whole notion of the curriculum and what education is for again. just thinking about, say, the German system and the notion of technical schools there.
Yeah.
Which here, when you think of the old sort of technical schools, you used to think of, oh, that's a second-class education for kids who weren't going to go to university. But actually, we need to do something about changing the status and purposes of education there, don't we? So that, like the Thomason report, probably had the the possibilities of opening it out so that academic and non-academic subjects were given some sort of equivalence in their weighting.
It's interesting that in many countries that has worked well, but we talk about it all the time. But it seems to me to be one of the entrenched things about the British system is that we've always had a snobbery, you know, around academia, you know, because we have an old established academic system. It has cachet and kudos that's perhaps, you know, more so than in Germany.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, here's a wee provocation because I had joked earlier that we should do a wee "What Would Ted Do?" You know, rather than just thinking the normal way, let's get a bit of provocation. See, here's one for you. What would be the effect? I'll give you the provocation and my explanation for cooking it up. What would be the effects of making education non-compulsory as a way of bringing equity to the system? The reason I'm saying that would be an interesting provocation, Steve, is that it seems to me that the families that pay for education, you know, the private schooling people or the people that have paid by buying into housing to get them into the right areas, definitely value their education, as you would if you're, you know, many thousands out of pocket for it. And I wonder if there's an argument for making school non-compulsory so that you're not obliged to give children an education so that if they get it, they value it. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's an interesting one. And that the schooling they did undertake would be run in some sort of agreement between what they felt they needed to do and what adults felt they ought to be doing, so that that there was much more voluntarism throughout the system in terms of choices and curriculum and what you could do. I suppose in terms of what would be the issue about of children or young people not doing anything then? I mean, the kind of if they had the ability to opt out altogether.
I mean, I guess, you know, one harsh view is, well, then, you know, they don't do anything, they have to be alternative pathways for them. But the point being, as long as you continue to say that we'll keep a safety net for you in school, then you get kids who are not committed to it, they don't work hard, indeed they become disruptive influences, and they ensure that, you know, that the local school in a deprived area can never become a magnet level performer, you know, you're assuming that those kids have got the intelligence to do that, and I'm sure they do. So in a sense, you perhaps have to be harsh to be kind in this imaginary world.
Sure.
And then perhaps kids will hang around for a month or two doing nothing, and then their parents will say, I want you in school now. And you start to value it when you realise that the alternatives are not good. But you're right, the alternatives have to be more than just hanging around in the street corners. So,
there'll also be there'll be presumably some social and self motivation to actually get an education, because education has value. I mean, part of the problem we have at the moment, as you said, is kind of compulsory education does cause resistance, you know. Undoubtedly, a lot of young people who are disengaging and resisting the whole kind of performance factory model, and so if self motivation would obviously be the ultimate cachet of good learning, wouldn't it? I wondered if there was, you need to think again, thinking more locally in terms of how would we encourage communities and businesses to open their doors in more ways to young people. So actually you young person could say, well, I want a kind of a map of learning that says I want to, I don't know, an apprenticeship for a couple of years. I want to work in this setting for a couple of years. I want to do a bit of cramming for a couple of years, you know, so that you could work out some sort of alternative life plan.
Yeah.
But you'd have to be able, you'd have to, again, that's what I mean about localism. I think those things are kind of best managed in very kind of local situations. You couldn't set up some sort of national system for doing that.
Well, I don't know that you couldn't. You know, if you had a, you know, a national body running education, you could set up a reward system. In fact, you might be better placed to set up rewards for local businesses on a national tax break basis, something like that.
Yeah, so you could get tax incentives for businesses, couldn't you, on the national basis? Yeah, but I think the pathways would have to be determined locally. I mean, that's a local kind of decision.
Okay, so there's something in that provocation. We're just about out of time. We're a little longer than we wanted to go, but yeah. I guess this needed a bit of time. Right, can I throw another couple at you for fun? Are you up for it?
Yeah, go on then.
Right, okay. Same challenge, okay? Someone set the challenge of responding to this this report. We want more equity in schools. What would happen if Richard Branson took over the system? It's that De Bono thing again, isn't it? You know, for listeners, you know, these provocations are about saying, well, what are the interesting features of what these people or these situations do, and then trying to apply it back to some creative thinking, a wee bit of out of the box. It's not an easy one, is it, thinking about what Richard Branson actually did? It's charismatic, I suppose.
Yeah. No, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, as you said, on one level, there's the kind of, there's that image of the charismatic entrepreneur who's always sort of innovating. But do you need that charisma and constant tinkering in the education system? Haven't we had enough constant tinkering? There's also, I suppose why I'm hesitating here is I've having been brought up in the notion of public service, there's this, I've always sort of railed against the ideology, if you like, that the private sector knows best, and actually what the public service lacks is a bit of private sector drive and entrepreneurship.
Sure, but for the purpose of this one, move beyond that and just think of the, right, so you're not allowing Branson to bring private sector thinking to this then, but what other things would he bring to it? So you can constrain him. There you go. You can do what you like here.
So what's the point of bringing him in then?
Is that all he does, yeah?
If he, strain him already. No, I don't know. I mean, I know he kind of started on a very small scale and built up a huge empire of businesses. So he's obviously able to think creatively.
So is there something there about doing exactly that then? Maybe instead of us trying to think as we've done about a global, you know, sorry, that's the wrong word, a UK national or a Scottish or English or Welsh national body to have long-term thinking for education, perhaps within that you would put a Branson-like figure with charisma and the ability to, for want of a better word, make sexy what a couple of small schools are doing, and have them as hothouses of you know, like the KIPP schools in America, like, you know, but perhaps with more British values.
But isn't that what some of the free schools and academies are doing? That's they're kind of, you know, there's a sort of Branson-like figures already involved in education, aren't they?
Perhaps. But are they scaling? Because one of the things with so many of those is that they're about that local interest again, rather than someone whose view has been to build up a national movement. So perhaps if you could be creating these, you know, KIPP-like, I don't mean in the same model, but, you know, that idea of taking on tough areas and only having kids in that are going to commit to success, making them successful. And then there's the Branson thing, never mind the private market thing, that's irrelevant here. The idea of building up a, you know, a movement that starts to scale nicely and becomes huge. And actually, you know, you could almost eat the old system from within.
Yeah, but it's all very well if you're selling records or running trains or trying to fly a plane out of an airport. But, I mean, if you're dealing with local contexts, which on the surface, you know, have many similarities, you know, we could all cite the similarities between different localities. But actually, each context has also got some very, very specific nuances, of very specific relationships. I think this thing has to be very context specific.
Okay, and in terms of our creative game, of course, right, move on from that, so you don't like that. See if you can pull one feature out from this that would please you.
What, from the...
from the Branson fantasy idea here.
Well, I think from that Branson Fantasy idea, the feature that I pull out is that we ought to get a number of creative minds around the table, and that are outside the department, and start thinking creatively. But also, I do. I mean, we've talked tonight on a systemic level quite a lot, haven't we? Because we talked about politics and international comparisons. And so we talked about systems issues. But there's something in what the political scientist Albert Hirschman said, you know, that we often talk in big grand terms because actually we lack the imagination to look at the modest details which make the difference. So I wonder, perhaps the next time we do have this conversation, obviously, we've got to talk in terms of the big systems, but whether it's actually what are the kind of tinkering things we can do within our current institutions that might be a bit more radical.
Okay, excellent. Well, I think we need to put that one to bed, and I have the nice sense that we're just starting a one-hour conversation that requires a good glass of malt whiskey in our hands, which is probably not a bad place to leave. It means that we get plenty to talk about in future programmes.
Hopefully other people will come and join the rambling.
Certainly be good if at least on Twitter or commenting on the blog, if anyone fancy doing that for a change, you know, it'd be good to hear other people's ideas, even if they were a bit off the wall, just to get some debate going around how we could, you know, see this system evolving over the next 10 years to be much more equitable, because it's clearly, you know, it's clearly a bit of an embarrassment to us internationally now that it's not.
Yeah, and also, it's apart from anything else, it's a lot of lives wasted, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's absolutely clear that it's New Labour's fault. It's equally clear that it's the current coalition's fault, if you read the stories. Be good to move on from that nonsense and see if anyone's just got some good ideas.
Absolutely.
Anyway, okay, so we're looking forward to Charlie joining us next week, and... We're still trying to reschedule Alison, who couldn't make last week. We've been on a bad luck the last 2 weeks, but we'll get both Jay and Alison back on soon. And listeners will be pleased because it will curtail us a little bit, Steve.
Yeah, stop us rambling too much.
So, till next week then.
Yeah, good night.
Good night, Steve.